that's the.
I know Wednesday night, it's always hard for people to get here about the 7 o'clock hour. I found that in the auditorium all the time. But I hope there'll be several more come in, because I think it's so important we try to keep up with the studies in Isaiah. I told, I think it was Aurelia, I said, have you ever had a class in math in the high, in school? And it was important for every lesson. If you missed a lesson, you kind of missed out on some things. So studying Isaiah, well, you know, one just doesn't exactly feel like a math class, but it is important to try to keep up one with the other. And I hope thus far you've not become discouraged, but rather encouraged to say, hey, it doesn't read like maybe some parts of the Bible. And maybe a little more, takes a little more thought. Well, what's this talking about? And backing off. But it's a great book, obviously, for having so many sites of quotations in the New Testament. I said some 60 quotations in the New Testament. Some 85 different citations of those. Some of those 60 are repeated more than once. Obviously, it's an important prophecy. And we also, many times, you know, Isaiah is called the dean of the prophets or the messianic prophet, and consequently, that attributes the fact that it is a very important study. We began, of course, with chapter 1, and that's kind of, you might say, a prototype of the whole book. And if you grasp that, then you kind of grasp, really, what is the major role and purpose of our Isaiah. And in those chapters, of course, we learn some things of God's attitude toward his people. So let me start always. I want to kind of, till we get really where we can just answer them like that, some questions about Isaiah. First of all, somebody were asking you, what does the word Isaiah mean? What would you say, Doug? His word, his name. Literally means, anybody?
Prophet, spokesman.
No, that's what a prophet is. His name means salvation of the Lord.
Exactly.
Name means salvation of the Lord. And if you were to give an approximate date in the history of the Old Testament, where would you fit Isaiah? What dates do we usually give for him? About what?
700 BC.
You said?
739 to 690.
All right. We say somewhere around 739 because in our lesson tonight, it was in the year that King Uzziah died that he had the vision of the Lord and the call. And we usually date that somewhere around 739 BC. And if he prophesied for nearly something like 50 years or so, somewhere around 690. It's hard to be just exact and say this is definitely it, but in that period of time. So if you're thinking about Old Testament history, where does that fit? First of all, and I say where does it fit, with the nation of Israel. Were they still as one body or had they already divided?
Divided.
Or had a divided kingdom, didn't they? And in fact, when did the northern 10 tribes fall into the hands of the Assyrian captivity? What date do we usually give for that?
720, 722.
Yeah, somewhere around 722 generally is the date we'll give, which means Isaiah was very active at the time the northern kingdom was taken into the hands of the Assyrians. Well, when do we date for Judah falling? You might give three different dates. I mean, first of all, when was Daniel taken captive? It's usually when we'll start with the fall.
And it was 605.
605 B.C. John just taught all this, if you guys were in the class here in this class last time. But when was the temple just about destroyed? Usually 687 to 686, somewhere around there. Now, why would I bring that up? Except if Isaiah finished his prophecy around 690, I said 687, I mean 587, about 100 years before the temple was destroyed, his last work. So, give or take. So the prophecy of Isaiah is certainly important in the history. I want you to get the time in your mind and background. And obviously, if the northern kingdom was taken into captivity 722, Isaiah wasn't taken captive because where did he live? Where did Isaiah live?
Jerusalem.
All right, and he prophesied mainly to the southern kingdom, didn't he? To Judah. And therefore, why was there a need for him? What was the spiritual condition of Judah at the time he began his prophecy? Let me ask the other question. What was the economic condition?
They had all they needed.
Very prosperous, and that's how we got that last Sunday's lesson even. They were full of pride because of it. And, you know, with prosperity often comes the feeling of self-security. I think our nation is certainly on that trail. we're self-secure. We're not going to be defeated. We're not concerned at all. We may hear the news about what Iran's doing and North Korea's doing, whatever. But frankly, the average person in this country, we're quite self-secure. And we may be. We may not fall. But nations before us have fallen who thought they were secure, and Judah is one of them. It's a lesson learned from the Bible, the fact. The fact is that with that economic came and that self-security came, what kind of a spiritual attitude then? Yeah, this, that's enough. That says it. In fact, in chapter 1, what did God say? They were sick. How sick were they in a body?
Head to toe.
Head to toe. And how would God listen to their prayers? He wouldn't even listen to them. You see, that's another great lesson, I think, for today, because how many people today think, well, it doesn't really matter, we're, you know. I may not be very religious, but boy, when I get in trouble, I pray. But does God always hear everybody's prayer? He doesn't promise to hear everyone's prayer. And certainly those who are caught up with false religion. And yet these people were sacrificing to God. What made their religion false? Because they made sacrifices. What did God say about their sacrifices?
He didn't like it.
Well,
I
will not. I will not have them. In fact, God's wrath was really somewhat stirred up about. He said, "I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and fat of fed cattle. I don't delight in the blood of bulls and or of lambs or goats." Well, with that attitude, we learn how important it is, and Isaiah is going to stress it over and over and over again: the sins of Judah and how important it is to do God's will and God's way. In our lesson Sunday, in chapter 2, we learn, you might say, Jerusalem in the ideal. Because chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, is a very important prophecy. How that in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established in the top of the mountains. All nations shall flow into it. The word of the Lord will go forth from Jerusalem. A picture, I think, in prophecy of what the church, today the Lord's house, the Lord's family, exalted above all the hills. All nations flow into it, because it is not simply for those who may be born a Jew, but rather the gospel is for all. And the word of the Lord first was preached in Jerusalem. In Acts chapter 2, we read of that. But after those verses of chapter 2, he then talks about Jerusalem the real. Now that's Jerusalem the ideal. But then in chapter 2, beginning with about verse 6, he would say, verse 6 of chapter 2, "You have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with eastern ways." In other words, what's happened to you? Well, they got like the neighbors about them. They began to build their idols. And yet, in all of that, they still thought themselves quite secure. And they were full of pride. And therefore, he speaks about it in chapter 2, how that their pride would be brought down. And into chapter 3, in fact, how that he would just turn topsy-turvy, you might say. Their leaders would be taken down, their wise and their mighty, and in the place would be given children to reign and to rule, people of immature and certainly not good wisdom. What's going to happen to Judah? It is going to fall. God is going to take away. Even he talks about the women in the last few verses of chapter 3, because women were involved just like the men. And no doubt women influenced even the men of that time, but they were just as guilty as the men, we might say. So from Jerusalem the ideal to Jerusalem the real, and finally in chapter 4, the first three or four, really all of chapter 4, you might say Jerusalem the redeemed. And it's a messianic prophecy that there's going to be a time. So here's what Isaiah does. He prophesies to the people, repent, you're guilty before God, you need to turn back. But if you don't, God will spare how much? A remnant. He said you'd be like Sodom and Gomorrah if I did not at least spare the remnant. And so there would be, out of that come the messianic prophecies, the time of the future. God would remember his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. People didn't deserve it. His people didn't deserve it. But there seemingly always were at least a few who remained faithful. Now in chapter 5, our lesson starts with a parable. In the first few verses, it's easily understood. In verse 1, "My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up, he cleared out its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst, and also made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth what? Wild. The vineyard of the Lord. And what do you think this probably represents?
Rebellion.
It's not the first time that God has spoken of his people as though they were like a vineyard. But what has God done with his people? He's blessed them in every way. He made them a nation. It wasn't of their doing. They've prospered. They've been given the land to live in that God promised them. Even God had promised to Abraham, hadn't he? And as they came out of Egyptian bondage, they went to their land. And in every way, God had blessed them. And so, in verse 4, what more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Can you feel perhaps the exasperation of God? Jeremiah, even almost 100 years later, God through Jeremiah said much the same thing. Why have you turned against me? Jeremiah is often called the weeping prophet because he wept for the condition that was going to fall upon Jerusalem and Judah. He wept from God's perspective. It was kind of like this. What has God done? What has he not done that you needed? Why would you turn against the Lord? And so in chapter 5 of Isaiah, we have much that same kind of feeling and questioning. What more could I have done? And so in verse 5, he said, now please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned. Break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I'll lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. That's pretty hard, isn't it? Is that too hard? Why, verse 7, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice. What did he get? Oppression. He looked for righteousness. What did he get? A cry for help. And so in verse 8, woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field, etc. In one of your applications of this lesson, I referred you to this very point in Isaiah 5. In fact, verse 25, I went forward, where in Isaiah 5, verse 25, he says, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He has stretched out his hand against them, stricken them. The hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. The point I made from that, and as you look through this chapter, and we'll have some others later on too, this looks like a hard and uncaring God. Is that the kind of God that we would think of? I'm afraid in our generation of time, so many people, shall I say the common people of the world, have listened to some of denominational preachers who emphasize the love of God. Let's just preach love. Let's just preach the message of love. Well, obviously we can't overdo the love of God in the real sense, for God is love. The very fact that we have the promise of the provision for eternal life through Jesus Christ is an act of love. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. But what we must remember is God is a God of wrath as well. He is a God of justice. And we see that really especially as we look at passages like this. What did God do with his chosen people? Weren't the Jews God's chosen? Yeah. But did God say, well, now, you're my chosen, and it really doesn't matter what you do. I'm going to still bless you. It'll be all right. Is that the God you see in the Bible?
No.
Just the opposite, isn't it? He loved them. He provided for them, just like this vineyard is. He said, I planted. I dug out all the stones. I planted the very best vine, the choicest vine that you could find. I put in that vineyard. I made everything just especially for you. And what have you done with it? And so, is God unjust by having wrath? Certainly not. In fact, in chapter 5, there are 6 woes that are found in this chapter. And one of the things to me in studying the prophets is how much history really does repeat itself. And I mean by that, people of later generations all look back at this and say, well, you know, we're doing like they did. And we ought to learn a lesson from it. And surely if God's wrath was stirred up against those people that were chosen by him to be his people, you think his wrath would be stirred up against us? What are the 6 woes? Verse 8, first of all, woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. We'll talk about that for a moment, in just a moment. But what prophet is contemporary with Isaiah?
Micah.
Let's turn to Micah chapter 2. In Micah chapter 2 and in verse 2, I think we find even Micah saying something very similar to this same point. Micah 2 and verse 2. Well, I'll just say verses 1 and 2. You have it, Doug? Why don't you read it?
Woe to them that despise iniquity and work evil upon their beds when the morning is light. They practice it because it is in the power of their hand, and they covet fields and take them by violence, and houses and take them away. So they oppress a man and his house, even a man and his heritage.
All right. Both Micah and Isaiah speak of the covetousness, the average, the greed, the selfish ambition. In effect, rich landowners never get enough. You know, what is covetousness? You know anybody that's covetous? I often say, I think that's a question. You know, it's probably a deceitful kind of a sin. Because it's really not wrong to desire things, is it? No, we work hard with our hands and we may purchase things, and that's good. But the covetous person is never content. And in fact, his desire for more possesses him. That's really what covetousness becomes, where it really, you have this goal. And so he says, they join house to house and land to land. They never get enough. It's like a man says, I'm not covetous. I just want the property next to my fences. He gets that. I'm not covetous. I just want, and the same story, he keeps repeating until finally he's possessed by that. He's constantly striving for things. And what happens, Isaiah in here and Micah also, is in the process, what happens to the poor? Can the rich outbid the poor and take the property away from the poor? We ever hear stories sometimes of that happening? And where the rich are left without provision for them. And so I think that's number one woe. He said they join house to house, add field to field. But what will God do? Well, verse 10, what happens finally is he says, 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath. Now, we don't measure in ephahs and bath and homers. Anybody have happened to work that out, what he's talking about? Jim?
Bath is 6 gallons, a homer is 360 pounds, and an ephah is 36 pounds.
All right, translate that into our language now. What does he say when he says 10 acres will yield one bath?
Well, 6 gallons wouldn't be very much produce for right. 10 acres.
All right, 10 acres, I read somewhere where 10 acres is about what one yoke of oxen could plow in 10 days. You know, he'd plow about 1 acre a day. And then when he got through with all that, all it would yield would be 6 to 8 gallons. So that's not very good, right? And the ephah was a dry grain measurement, whereas the bath was a liquid measurement. But a homer, when he would say that a homer of seed shall yield 1 ephah, you'd hope if you went out and planted, you guys who are farmers, if you planted a gallon of seed, how much produce would you hope to get back from it?
A bunch.
More than a gallon?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, what this is saying, so you plant 10 gallons and you get only one back. One-tenth. The ephah is one-tenth of a homer. So that's what he's saying. Look, you go out and labor hard, but God's going to make you where you're not very prosperous at all. Woe to those who are covetous. Number, verse 11, woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, till wine inflames them. We have any people like that these days? Every now and then in the newspaper or the news, I hear something about the bars can stay open how late in Orlando?
Till two.
And I think some have been complaining that was too early. Right? Are there those who can't get enough?
We always have, you always have the private bars that can stay open after 2.
It can stay open after 2, yeah. There are those who search for them, right? So they, it says they continue until night, till wine inflames them. And not only that, the provocative music arouses the sensuous excesses. The verse 12, the harp and the strings, the tambourine, the flute, and wine are in their feasts. But they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished. Their multitude dried up with thirst. What do you mean they don't have any knowledge? Is there any reason why they don't have any knowledge? In Hosea chapter, all right, Dave, you start saying something. I'll let you say
it. Ears will not hear, and eyes will not see.
In Hosea even said, my people, or God through Hosea, my people are destroyed for their lack of knowledge, but he blamed the priests for not teaching and for the people for not listening. He said the priests have gotten to where they're just teaching what the people want to hear rather than teaching what God wants them to hear. And so, they have no knowledge, but don't blame, don't say God didn't give it to them. He provided, they shut their ears. In fact, in verse 14, Sheol has enlarged itself. Now, somebody may have a different word there instead of Sheol. What
hell.
Is Sheol?
The grave.
The grave?
Hell.
Right. I think the NIV has death right there, but still it's the same. So it's enlarged his mouth. In other words, God's going to make it where, are they just going to continue to revel in their wine and, it's always going to eat, drink, and be merry all the days that they want? No, there'll come a time where death has enlarged itself, opened its mouth beyond measure. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. People shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled. The eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment. And God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. Then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste places of the fat ones strangers shall eat. You see, within this, you have mixed together the wrath of God against the evil, but there's also the promise for those who are righteous. Those who are humble will be blessed by the Lord. Verse 18 starts the third of six woes. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity, and sin as if with a cart rope. that say, let him make speed and hasten his work, that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come, that we may know it. It seems that those verses are sort of a mockery, kind of a ridicule. It's defiance toward God that he's talking about.
You hear that today even.
Yeah. Well, wow, what has God done? Let him do something that we can see and know. But it's just said, that draw cords where he says that they... cords of vanity. With this mockery, it's like one would pull a wagon cart, and they have sin. It follows just like the wagon follows the ox in front of it. So it is that here goes, their sin continues to multiply. And they're saying all along, well, we don't see anything that God has done. Sort of mocking. Let him do something that we can see. Following that, in verse 20, they reverse moral distinctions. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. I ask on your thought question, can you give any examples of that happening today? Any illustrations of that maybe? Anybody come up with one? That happened today?
Sure. Just enforcing the speed limit.
Okay. All right.
People that want to speed, they don't want to see the speed limit enforced. In fact, when the police do it, they blame them for having quotas, and they blame them for speed traps, and they judge them for having evil motives.
Yeah. All right.
Something that should be good, enforcing the law, they consider it evil.
Evil. All right. Any other examples?
Divorce.
Divorce is good, isn't it? We're just so tired of one another, and God wants me to be happy. Anything else?
What about homosexualism?
Yeah, oh, this is the It's simply the alternate lifestyle. What's so wrong with homosexuality? Anything else? About abortion?
Oh, yes.
All right. Look at Romans chapter 1. Just to point out a word that's there. In Romans chapter 1, he speaks about how the wrath of God is stirred up against evil. Verse 18, and it continues on, listing some of the things that men have done. But in verse 24, is a series of three different verses that say God gave them up. Romans 1:24, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their bodies, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, exchange the truth of God for the lie. Sexual immorality is really the word that's there translated, uncleanness. In verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to vile passions. You may have a translation that renders that as homosexuality. Because, as he describes in the next verses, women exchange their natural use for what's against nature, men leaving the natural use of woman, burning lust for one another, men with men committing what's shameful. So here's homosexuality. But to me, when I get down to verse 28, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them, here's the word again, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. Debased mind. Anybody have a different word for that?
Retrobate.
Reprobate mind.
Depraved.
Depraved mind. Literally, it carries the idea, I'm told, in the Greek, they get to where they cannot distinguish right from wrong, good from evil. It's kind of like the verse of Isaiah 5:22. They call evil good and good evil. They transfer sweet for bitter, bitter for sweet. And there are people who have no fear of the Lord, even in our generation, who indeed have come to that point that, you know, God gave them up. He did not force them to serve him. He gave them over to do their own thing. They didn't want God, so, you know, God let them go. But what happens is, evil men wax worse and worse, as Paul wrote Timothy. And so you can get to the point where truly they don't feel any guilt because they don't have the sense of moral right from moral wrong. And I'm afraid we've got a lot in our generation and our nation who have reached that point. Does history repeat itself? Amen.
There's somewhere in the Bible where it says that the young does not blush.
Yeah. Well, there's the shame of their sin, right. They do not blush. It's in Jeremiah chapter 6, I think it is. But now, with verse 21, we have the fifth woe. Verse 21, woe to those who are what? Wise. In their own eyes, prudent in their own sight, conceit. Well, when man rejects the counsel of God, what happens to him? He's able to guide himself. And so, you know, even Solomon in Proverbs 14, there's a way which seems right unto man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. But many, many passages speak about that. Even this context in Romans chapter 1 I was just referring to says as much, that men, they become wise in themselves, thinking themselves to be wise. They really become foolish. They become as fools. But then finally, where he says in the verse 22, the sixth woe, they pervert justice and righteousness. Now, he speaks here again about them drinking wine, and yet it's a different one from the first or the second woe that we read back in verse 11. In verse 23, they're men mighty at drinking wine. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink. But here's what they do. Who justify the wicked for a bribe. Take away justice from the righteous man. So in their rulers whose addiction to strong drink prevented ruling with keen minds. And there's a facade of maybe they're performing important duties as judges, but their attitude is such that pay them a little bit under the table and they'll pervert justice. Again, let's look at Micah. In Micah chapter 3, we find Micah saying some of the similar things. In Micah chapter 3, verses, I believe it's 9 through 11, I want you to see. Micah 3, beginning in verse 9. Now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob, rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert all equity, who build up Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with iniquity. In verse 11 particularly. Her heads judge for what? A bribe. Her priests teach for pay. Her prophets divine for money. Even the religious leaders. You reckon there are any preachers today that do that?
Yeah.
Surely not. The rest of that verse says, yet they lean on the Lord. And they say, is not the Lord among us? No harm can come on us. I just think that's an outstanding portrayal of men past and present who think that it really doesn't matter. You know, well, we're right. We're religious. And yet they have perverted justice and righteousness of God. Mm-hmm.
What, yes, John? You know what the difference is in verse 22 that we're talking about men mighty at drinking wine, the difference between that and intoxicating drink?
Well, let's just say with verse 11, where he says these in verse 11 have the intoxicating drink, they continue with it all day long. They rise early and on into the night. Whereas I think in verse 22, you've obviously got something different. They're detached from each other. And I think the emphasis in verse 22 has to do with the fact that they are perverting justice. You know, I think let's do it this way. Probably the socially elite drink. But with it, they may not always be drunk, but they get high, and they probably sometimes they have their cronies that they will befriend and give what
need do business with.
Do business with, I guess is the right word. So I think the wine is more associated with that than with drunkenness, like verses 11 and 12 talk about. Patty?
You said it exactly before I even said it. Okay. They drink with their friends, and then they work out deals with their friends.
Yes, that kind of thing. I think that's more the idea. That's well said. Well, what is God's attitude toward it? Verse 25, therefore. Anytime you see the word therefore, you know it precedes what's before. The anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He stretched out his hand against them, stricken them, and the hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. We're going to get this later when we talk about the nations. What does it mean his hand is stretched out still? He doesn't relent. You know, we'd say, oh Lord, please quit. This is enough. I've been punished enough. But he said, no. He's going. In fact, what happens later is verse 26. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar. Anybody have a little different translation there? He calls out really what's describing here, Assyria. What's going to happen?
From a distant nation.
Right, a distant nation. And he will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they shall come with speed and swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt on their loins be loose, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. He's saying they're going to come with haste. And the Lord really is using them. Isaiah 10 and verse 5, he talks about Assyria as the rod of his anger. And so even here, he's given a prefix to it that God calls them and they will be used. In fact, in verse 28, their arrows are sharp. All their bows are bent. Their horses' hooves will seem like flint. Their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. Like a lion before its prey may roar. He said that's what they'll be like. In fact, they will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver them. And that day, they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. Kind of a dark picture, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But you see the justice of God against sin. That's really what you're seeing in this. Isaiah prophesied, and we look back and know the truth of it. It happened, just like God had promised it would. Chapter 6 is one of those chapters we sometimes wonder how Isaiah's put together. You'd have thought chapter 6 ought to be chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Isaiah's not written in a format like we would say, okay, every chapter follows chronologically behind the other. In fact, there's some question, and I don't know the answer, and I'm not sure anyone does that's living today to say how and why did it get put together in this form. we know it has two major divisions. In fact, we say the first, how many chapters are the Assyrian period?
39.
39, and the last 27 have to do with the Babylonian period. We can do that much. But other than that, sorting it out. But chapter 6 is, I think, one of the highlights of the chapter. You need to stop and think. How many times have you heard, hear my Lord, send me. What a great statement. What Isaiah sees in the year of King Uzziah died, he saw the Lord sitting on the throne, high, lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple. Can you imagine that? You ever been to a wedding where this bride has this long train? We don't have too many today like that. I guess I've seen it maybe with a marriage of Diana in England. You know, you see those royal weddings. But you wouldn't dare step on that train. I mean, you know. But this train fills the room. And while there are many scriptures in the Bible of God's being certainly approachable, yet here's one where he is exalted. And you don't really approach. The train fills. And then what happens? Above it stood the seraphim. Each one with six wings. With two he covered his face. With two he covered his feet. With two he flew. And again, we can imagine why is it all like that. Maybe there's some sense of humility with it as they cover their face and they cover their feet. But they cry, one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And then in that moment, the posts of the door were shaken. Now, if you were in this presence, can you imagine? What if all of a sudden, we've had a rainstorm tonight, but what if all of a sudden this building began to tremble? But you knew it wasn't just a storm from nature. Maybe you're in the temple area. You're in the vision with God. You know the posts are shaking because of God's presence. And further than that, the voice of him who cried out, the house was filled with smoke. Kind of awe-inspiring, right? So I said, verse 5, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." What do you think he's saying? I'm undone. Any reason to think Isaiah was a bad kid growing up, got in all kind of trouble?
Didn't see God was to die.
That's right. And frankly, in comparison with God, who is he? I mean, I'm trying to say here, maybe as far as we know, might have been a good, you know, we say, well, he came from good people. In fact, his father was probably the brother of the king, royalty, and yet he said, "I'm a sinner. Who am I?"
Yeah, I've come more to the understanding there's more and more people today who don't think that they think, "Oh, I'm a good guy."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's hard to convince them of the necessity and the nature of their sin.
Exactly.
And the really terrible nature of it. And that ultimately comes from a lack of knowledge of who God is.
Absolutely.
And how perfect and exalted he is.
We people tend to compare themselves with other people.
Sure.
I know I'm a lot better than that person on the side of the street with a sign up, "I'm homeless." I know I'm a lot better than that person that's in jail. And frankly, we might even be in a group like this and say, "Ooh, I think I'm better than that fellow over there. You know, I'm here all the time. He doesn't come, or she, whatever." We make comparisons. But the very best in the presence of God can say, "I'm undone. Who am I?" So what happens here? Here's he feeling the guilt of his sin in comparison with God, and one of the seraphim comes having a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar. He touched my mouth with it and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away. Your sin purged." Talk about the grace of God. Number one, we were talking about the normative man's sin in comparison with the holiness of God. And then number two, the grace of God. Did he deserve this? Nothing had he done to deserve this. And really, when we say we're saved by grace, we have done nothing to deserve forgiveness of sins. Only by the grace of God has he made the provision for it. And then you could say, and I'm hurrying through this, I wish I'd left more time for it, but in verse 8, "I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? Who will go for me?" And Isaiah quickly says, I'm here on my Lord, send me. Now at this point, as he asks, "Lord, where is it that you're going to send me, and how long will I be there? What am I going to be doing?" He doesn't say any of those, does he? What's he told? He might want to change his mind when you read the rest of this. Because the rest of it, he said, "Go and tell this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull, the ears heavy. Shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and return and be healed. Wait a minute, Isaiah. You're supposed to go and you're not going to have any success. I mean, the people you preach to, they don't want to hear it. They won't understand it. They're going to close their eyes. You still want to say, "Hear my Lord, send me"? Anybody note how many times that verses 9 and 10 is quoted in the New Testament? This is one of those one quotation that's found 5 times. It's quoted in Matthew 13:13-15. I asked that on your question. John chapter 12:40, Mark chapter 4:12, Luke chapter 8:10, and Acts 28 verses 26 and 7. And you have that in your workbook lesson too, those verses. So how many times people may hear and do not understand? Is it God's fault?
No.
Can see but don't perceive. Because why? They close their eyes and close their ears. But I'm going to finish. Verse 11, then I said, "Lord, how long?" And he answered, "Until the cities are laid waste and without inhabitant, the houses are without a man, the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men from afar, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. But yet a tenth will be in it, and will return and be for consuming." Is that a remnant, maybe? "As a terebinth tree or as an oak, whose stump remains when it's cut down, so the holy seed shall be its stump." There will still be, you know, the tree itself may be taken in captivity, but there's going to be a stump there, and out of it will grow a new beginning. So out of the remnant, God's people still came forth. Messiah was born of the seed of Abraham. Well, I wish I had more time. I want to go to those questions. I might start Sunday morning with those questions, so.